My name is Rachel Daly, and I'm the former president of UVA Law's Federalist Society chapter. I'm so honored. I'm so honored to be here tonight to introduce our featured speakers, Judge Amol Thapar of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit and Judge Andrew Oldham of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit. I have the immense privilege of calling them both my judges. I currently serve as a law clerk to Judge Oldham, and I'll be clerking for Judge Thapar next year. I figure this audience already knows a bit about tonight's speakers. If you're a member of the Federalist Society, you've probably heard them speak before, and perhaps you've even read some of their opinions. So instead of reciting their many impressive credentials and repeating lines you've heard elsewhere, I thought I'd share a few things you may not already know. You may not know that in addition to being the speakers for tonight's banquet, Judge Oldham and Judge Thapar are the very reason we're all here in Charlottesville, spending the weekend discussing the founding era dialogue between the Federalists and Anti-Federalists. Most originalists are well-versed in the Federalist Papers, but many have never studied the other side of the founding debate. Judge Oldham and Judge Thapar have led the charge to change all of that, working for several years now to elevate the Anti-Federalist writings to our attention. It's a project they've pursued in large part here at UVA Law. Since 2020, they've co-taught Founders and Foes, an annual January term course exploring the arguments for and against the Constitution. I was lucky enough to snag a coveted spot in the seminar the first time they taught it together, and it was that class that made this weekend possible. After taking Founders and Foes, a group of us here at UVA were inspired to explore the topic further, turn it into a symposium proposal, and spend the next 2 years working to bring this weekend to fruition. Perhaps you're surprised that one week-long seminar would inspire a group of students to spend 2 years thinking about the Anti-Federalists in their free time. But if you know Judge Oldham and Judge Thapar, you know it is not at all unusual that a chance interaction with them would inspire momentous efforts. They tend to have that effect on people. Of course, part of it is that they are both brilliant judges, widely and rightly admired for the substance and style of their judicial opinions. But another part of it is the infectious energy and joy they bring to their day-to-day work, deciding cases, teaching classes, and mentoring young lawyers. It's simply impossible to listen to them for more than a few minutes and not want to follow wherever they lead. And tonight, you all get to see what I mean. Because for the next hour or so, you've each snagged a coveted spot in the Founders and Foes seminar. I think you'll quickly see, as I did, that it is not only a privilege, but also a total delight to study the founding debates with these two great teachers. Please join me in welcoming Judge Amol Thapar and Judge Andrew Oldham.
What an introduction. That was incredible.
That was amazing. And now you see why people call us brilliant, because the only thing we really do well is hire brilliant law clerks
exactly.
Like Rachel.
Exactly right.
And then wind them up and let them go.
That's right. I can't believe what an honor it is to be here at the Share Stage with you. I can't thank enough the Federalist Society for making this event possible, to Gene and to Dean and to Lisa Zell, and for all the work that has gone into this from the symposium creators. And just a chance to spend an hour with you is like, it's a highlight of my weekend.
Well, I'm grateful that you all bought tickets and came to this event. We learned the reason you bought tickets is you thought Governor Youngkin was gonna be speaking. So it's just an honor to serve as the backup.
Yeah, no kidding.
And be here with you all. And we do appreciate the Federalist Society having us. And I can't tell you what a privilege it is to be able to teach at UVA with maybe two of the greatest co-teachers anyone could ever ask for. For a long time, I taught with my mentor and friend, Lillian Bevere, who you all heard from. And you saw how brilliant she is. Just imagine a week, a semester, or a year of classes with her. Mm-hmm. And it was incredible. It was maybe the highlight of my career to be able to teach with someone so brilliant and so thoughtful and honestly so courageous that taught me what courage was. And then to move on and teach with someone that's like a brother to me is just a real privilege. And I think the only way people can tell that we're not brothers is they hear him talk and they say, there is no way someone that brilliant can have a brother like me.
That is not even remotely true. I'm a small town country lawyer and an anti-federalist at heart, so.
Dressed like Alexander Hamilton, if you notice.
Well, listen, someone had to present the debate, right? Someone had to be the Hamiltonian, so I figured I'd wear a tuxedo. Plus, I get to wear my Texas sunset. So
an elitist Hamiltonian like yourself.
Oh, my goodness.
How is it possible you could become interested in the anti-federalists?
Well, I you can tell I often have to play the foil. You know, it's interesting. My interest in the anti-federalists started with the Federalist Society. You know, when I first went to a Federalist Society event when I was a student in law school, it was not cool to even read the Federalist Papers. One of my law school mentors was famous for having said that the Federalist Papers were not just like legislative history, they were anonymous propaganda. So it was the sort of worst form of information. Why in the world would you ever even read them? So I felt like a rogue student for just reading the Federalist Papers. And it never even dawned on me that I should read the thing to which the Federalist Papers were responding. So it wasn't until many, many years later, I was looking up some obscure provision in the Founders Constitution, and I came across my first anti-federalist essay. It was by Brutus. And I read it and I thought, holy cow. Look at this. It is an entire different story, an entire different idea. And in the spirit of the Federalist Society, how can you not read both sides? How can you not actually consider the merits of the debate? How can you only think of one side of the argument? And from there, I started to read more and more and more. And as Rachel pointed out, a lot of my interest in the Anti-Federalists comes from the University of Virginia and the course that we teach here. And I don't think that we can gather in Charlottesville and talk about the Anti-Federalists without talking about the man, Herbert Storing, who was a longtime professor here at the University of Virginia, and without whom I'm not sure we would know anything that we know about the Anti-Federalists today. It was his life work to collect Anti-Federalist thought, to publish it with a series of notes, and that book, The Complete Anti-Federalist by Herbert Storing, which he did not even live to see published, remains the definitive work on the topic today. Tragically, he died too young in 1981 and never saw the book actually published. But it's the thing that we still look to today. It is the thing that we cite in opinions when we cite to the Anti-Federalists. It's the thing that the Supreme Court cites when they cite to Anti-Federalist opinions. And so that book really was a formative interest of mine. And I'm curious, you know, we've obviously talked a lot about this. We've talked about how we use the Anti-Federalists in thinking about the Constitution. Why do you think, Judge Barr, that the Anti-Federalists matter?
Yeah, I won't surprise you. Totally agree with Judge Oldham that the Anti-Federalists are a critical component of the debate. It would be like a judge for all the people that have never picked up and read the Anti-Federalists. To summarize what Judge Oldham said differently, it would be like a judge just picking up the respondent's brief, reading it, and then deciding. And that's what too many judges and jurists and lawyers and professors and everyone else have done for too long. They've read one side of the debate. They've used it to help them figure out what the Constitution means without ever seeing the other side. To me, that's remarkable. Then the other thing I think that dawns on people when you read the Anti-Federalists is how right they were about their predictions, about what would happen. And so every time we teach the class, I hope our students come walk away like Rachel did and think, wow, they really understood in a way. But the other thing you start to grasp is even though the Federalists were too arrogant at times to admit they were responding to the Anti-Federalists, if you read them together, you actually see it. You see him quoting them. You see him referencing them, sometimes unfairly demeaning them. But I think it's really important if you want to understand what the Constitution means to read both sides.
What do you think? We've talked about this from time to time, but you've cited Anti-Federalist work in your opinions. When you go to do that, what are you thinking about? Are you thinking that what the Anti-Federalists said about the Constitution is what the Constitution means? Are you saying it's because they predicted something rightly or wrongly? I mean, one of the things that I've been reminded of from time to time is that the Anti-Federalists lost, so why would we care?
Yeah, now I hate when people say that they're losers. I don't think they're losers in the debate because we wouldn't have a Bill of Rights but for the Anti-Federalists. So, I think it's really important that when you think about what it means, you look at that and you work with the Anti-Federalists and Federalists. And so if I'm going to cite a Federalist paper in an opinion, and I know an Anti-Federalist paper goes along with it, I'm going to cite them both because you're going to better understand it. So, for example, one of the things, Judge Oldham referenced Brutus. Well, I love Brutus. He's one of my favorite Anti-Federalists. And he often talked about the judiciary. In fact, a lot of people say originalism arose in response to the Warren Court. But if you go back and read Brutus, the one fear he talked about so often was judges interpreting the Constitution consistent with its spirit rather than its meaning. And if you look at Brutus, you see that he gave a perfect definition of originalism. And so for those that say it began 40, 50 years ago, they weren't reading Brutus, because Brutus was talking about it. And guess what? Hamilton responded to him. And Hamilton said, no, don't worry, Brutus. Don't worry, Anti-Federalist. Judges will interpret the Constitution consistent with its terms and not with its spirit. He was half right.
One of the things I wonder about sometimes is, you know, when you see a Federalist and an Anti-Federalist essay, and they're both talking about the same part of the constitutional text, sometimes they disagree. This is a great example. They disagreed about how Article 3 was going to work. But sometimes they agree. Sometimes they look at some provision in Article 1, Section 8, for example, the enumeration of congressional power, and they agree about what those terms mean. What are we supposed to do with that when we have an agreement between the two of them as opposed to a disagreement?
Well, I'd be curious as to your thoughts, because we've talked about this some, but I think agreements obviously are conclusive, but I think disagreements are interesting because what happens is we've interpreted the Constitution so broadly. And when you look at the disagreement, you also see promises. So the Anti-Federalists will say, wait a minute, no. You're going to use the Interstate Commerce Clause and the Necessary and Proper Clause to allow federal government to grow to where we can't, state governments have no say, to where the federal government takes over. And Hamilton says, and Madison, no, that's not going to happen. We promise. These are limited powers. Well, when you understand the debate, you understand what the promise is worth. And if you understand the promise in response to the criticism, you understand more about the original meaning. But what would you say on that?
Yeah, I think one of the ways I think about it is if the point of the way to interpret the Constitution, what you think originalism is you're an original intent originalist. That is, you care about the 55 people who put their name to that document. Then maybe you don't care about the Anti-Federalists because there were no Anti-Federalists who did that. But if instead you are an original public meaning originalist, you care about what educated people at the time of the founding understood those words to mean, well, then you should care about the Anti-Federalists as much as you care about the Federalists. You should care about the non-Federalists for that matter. And if there are people who are interested and learned in reading these provisions of the Constitution and then debating them in newspapers across the country, you should care what the Anti-Federalists understood those words to mean. In some ways, you should care about the Anti-Federalists more because their papers were written more broadly. There are more of them. They talked about different provisions of the Constitution than the Federalists. You know, that most people forget that the Federalist Papers, as important as they were, as influential as they were published only in New York. They were published altogether as a book after the ratification of the Constitution. They were relatively lightly read at the time of the ratification debates. Whereas the Anti-Federalist essays were being published all over the country, and they were being published in much quicker succession. They were published first before the Federalist responses. And so if the point of it is to understand, if what we're doing in an originalist exercise is to understand what the original public meaning of a text is, then the anti-Federalists are at least as important, I would say, as to Federalist thought.
What would you say, and this question comes up in our class all the time, what would you say to those who say this is just legislative history? Mm-hmm. Like, all you're doing is, yeah, you're talking about they're only read in New York, but who really outside of lawyers and judges reads legislative history? And so, okay, maybe they're only read in New York, and maybe the anti-Federalists were read a little more broadly or read more broadly generally, but all of it's just how we got to the Constitution. So you're using legislative history, even though you won't do it with statutory interpretation.
So I think there's a very important interpretive principle that is embedded in that question. And that is, when you're reading a paper, whether it's a Federalist essay, an anti-Federalist essay, or something published by neither of them, are you reading it to say, this is what I understand the Constitution to mean, which that strikes me as kind of a legislative history heuristic, or are you instead reading it to understand what the word, for example, taxation meant in 1787 and 1788 and 1789? Are you reading it to understand what does the word commerce mean in the late 18th century? Are you understanding, are you reading whatever this essay is, let's say it's an anti-Federalist essay, to understand what the vesting clause in Article 2, Section 1 is supposed to mean? And if you're doing the latter, then you're not actually relying on it the way courts sometimes rely on legislative history. You're instead relying on it to understand the way people in the late 18th century used words. And in that sense, it's an interpretive question that really bears very little resemblance to relying on legislative history. So I have a question for you about, you know, one of the things that we're doing in the symposium this weekend is we're revisiting the founding era debate. And one of the criticisms that is often raised is that why should we care about the Constitution? It was written by a bunch of dead white men. Why does it retain relevance today? So what would you say to that?
Yeah, I would say here's one of the big shames of what's left and taught of civics and history is they've left out the anti-feds. And included one of the most important anti-Federalists was a Colombian patriot. And a Colombian patriot was Mercy Otis Warren, a woman who wrote under the pseudonym a Colombian patriot. And for a while, for many years, everyone assumed it was Elbridge Gerry. What reality revealed in the papers of both Gerry and Warren revealed is it was Mercy Otis Warren who was writing this. Maybe one of the best anti-Federalist papers about the Bill of Rights. If you haven't read it, I encourage you to read it. So, one of the great women of the founding generation, along with Abigail Adams and several others, is Mercy Otis Warren. And Mercy Otis Warren, in large part, is the brains behind the Bill of Rights. So I think they're wrong when they say that. They forget about Mercy Otis Warren. Another incredible woman was Mum Bett. Maybe not an anti-Federalist, but had the heart and mind of an anti-Federalist. She was a slave in Massachusetts. Some say and believe, I think the record shows, she was the first slave to sue for their freedom after the Declaration of Independence came out. And she sued for her freedom and won and changed her name to Elizabeth Freeman. And Elizabeth Freeman became a proud homeowner, mother, grandmother, and an amazing person. And here's someone that had the foresight to understand the Declaration of Independence in a way that strikingly even the people that dressed like Judge Oldham could not. So how is it that the Federalists who participated and screwed up included slavery in the Constitution? Tell me.
Well, it's an interesting question. It's another point of, you know, if we're gonna revisit the founding era debates, I think it is incumbent to talk about that topic. It is obviously the odious sin that is written into the Constitution. And one of the reasons I think we should focus on the anti-Federalists is that they were among the most prominent critics of the Constitution to point out this problem at the time. One person who did it, many of the people that we talk about in the Federalist, Anti-Federalist debate wrote under pseudonyms, but one man who did not need a pseudonym to criticize the Constitution, one man who did not need a pseudonym to talk about slavery was George Mason. And George Mason, a Virginian, was a staunch and ardent critic of the Constitution, refused to sign it in Philadelphia, and one of his principal criticisms of the document was that it perpetuated slavery in two different ways. Obviously, the odious Three-Fifths Clause and the 1808 Clause, Article 5 of the Constitution, which provides for amendments of the Constitution, prohibited amendments of the slavery provisions until 1808, 20 years after the ratification of the document. And one of the things that George Mason said, and he said it prominently, he said it on the floor of the convention hall in Philadelphia in that steamy summer of 1787, he said it in the Virginia ratification debates, he said that slavery and slave owners are born petty tyrants. And he said that because nations cannot be punished in the next life, cannot be punished in the afterlife, they must be punished in this one. And therefore, national sins will befall national calamities, effectively predicting the Civil War, effectively predicting that slavery would tear the nation apart. On the other hand, there were some Federalists, not Hamilton, Madison, and Jay necessarily, but people like Oliver Ellsworth of Connecticut, who was a very staunch Federalist and very staunch supporter of the Constitution, who was part of the brains behind, the so-called brains behind the Three-Fifths Clause that was hammered out at the very end of the Philadelphian Convention, and was added as a compromise between two Southern states and three New England states. And so this is not necessarily to say that the Anti-Federalists were more or less anti-slavery than the Federalists were, but I do think it's fair to say that the Anti-Federalists were far less willing to compromise on the proposition. And it was a central tenet of Anti-Federalist thought. And so if we're going to revisit the founding debates and we're going to talk about this topic, which I think is incumbent upon us when we talk about the Constitution to recognize its faults, Anti-Federalist thought is a natural place to look to understand the contours of that debate in the 1780s and today. I think it's really, one thing I want to do is hear from the audience. And so we have two microphones that are set up in the back of the back of the hall. So please feel free to line up. We would love to hear your questions and do back and forth. As long as it doesn't involve pending cases, we'd love to hear what you're thinking about. And while folks are queuing and you're thinking of your questions, Judge Thapar, one thing I think that's profound about being in front of such an incredible audience like this one is that there are presumably definitely scores, probably hundreds of either current law clerks or future law clerks. And so I'm curious if you have anything you would say to them, either about your own clerkship experience, the way you relate to your law clerks, your thoughts on clerking.
Well, I could take the next hour talking about this, but I think one of the things, the job is a very serious and important one that we do. And so when all of you become law clerks, it is also a serious and important job that you all do. And we, I think, both take the job very seriously, take our responsibility to get the law right very seriously. And it's incumbent upon you all to take it with the same level of seriousness. It doesn't mean that we're important. It means the job we do is important. And I love my law clerks dearly. They are the brains behind the operation. And I enjoy the debate with them. I enjoy discussing it. But more than anything else, I enjoy the work we put in to figure out and get the law right. And remember, there are parties' lives who are being affected by us. And so we don't get to make it up on our own. We don't get to say what we think the best outcome is. When I go talk in law schools about originalism and other things, sometimes they say, Judge Thapar, you sound perfectly rational. Why don't you just do what you want to do? And we would be happy with that. And I always say, you really want to live in my kids' world, maybe you should ask them beforehand. But with all seriousness, if we get to make it up as we go, it's nothing like what the founders, Anti-Federalist or Federalist envision. And so what's most interesting to me, and I love hearing Judge Oldham talk about this, so I'm going to turn it back on him in a minute before we get answers, but
is that we take this oath. And that oath is something judges should remember every day. But you know who else takes the oath? Is law clerks. Hmm. You all come in and we give you that oath. And I always give the oath in my office. And I think it's so important that we all pay attention to the words of the oath and understand the immense responsibility that we have in trying our best to get it right. And get it right means following the law, not making it up as we go.
Yeah, I could not possibly, as with many things, I could not agree with you more. One of the things that I tell my law clerks from time to time is that I took my oath on the Bible that my grandfather flew with in the cockpit of his airplane in World War II and in Korea. And it's the oath I took in my investiture. It is the Bible that I put my hand on when I swore to uphold and defend the Constitution. And I put that Bible in a case right next to my desk and a picture of my grandfather, who's now in heaven. And every day when I walk into my office and I go to sit down at my desk, I walk past that Bible and I walk past that picture. And every single day, I give occasion to think about him and the sacrifices that men and women throughout our nation's history have made, in uniform and without, to serve and defend our nation. And I will take that applause as a thanks to the men and women in uniform who have served our nation, because that without them, we do not have the Constitution to uphold and defend. We don't have the right to debate in this country. We don't have the right to meet together and to break bread together at a symposium like this one. And it's a consequence of the severity of that sacrifice of people dying in foreign countries and on beaches, the names of which they cannot pronounce, that we have the judicial power of the United States. It is the most solemn thing that the people could vest in us. And so it doesn't matter if it's a motion for an extension of time or the most weighty constitutional question conceivable in America today. I take it that seriously because I think of my grandfather, who looks down from heaven, would want me to. And so I hope that every one of you who ever has occasion to either serve in office and take that oath or to serve as a law clerk and take the oath that Judge Thapar referenced earlier, will think about that constantly in your discharge of duty. So with that, we're droning on and on. Let's go to questions.
I told you we could talk for hours.
I know.
And we do, so.
Let's start on this side.
Hi, thank you so much for being here, Judge Oldham and Judge Thapar. My question is about how the Constitution vests judicial power, legislative power, and executive power in three separate branches. But did the Anti-Federalists foresee that we would see a blending over of powers, specifically with delegation of legislative power to the executive branch over time?
Yeah, in one way the Federalists were right, in one way the Anti-Federalists were right. The Anti-Federalists were so worried about the blending of powers that they even questioned the vice president being the leader of the Senate, because you were now blending the powers, you're giving the executive legislative powers. And they complained about all of this. Confirmation they complained about, because again, it was blending of powers. And what they worried, in hindsight, at least by my perspective, I think the Federalists got some things right. I think we uniformly like some of the blending, but what the Anti-Federalists were so worried about was overblending of powers, which has happened a lot, and perhaps, and we could go on for hours, so I don't know if I want to tee this up, but yeah. Judge Oldham just wrote a concurrence.
Oh, no.
Should I not tee it up?
Oh, no.
I mean, Professor Walker got the Story Award, right? Yeah. Just for a minute. I'm going to give you a minute. Do I have a stopwatch on this watch? I don't know, but Judge Oldham just wrote a concurrence about the administrative state and the blending of powers that is just masterful. And maybe we should just assign it to everyone to read it. And about Woodrow Wilson and what his intent was with the administrative state. So you get, can you do it in a minute?
I can do it in less than that because I'm not talking about that.
oh, come on.
But I will say, if you've never read Cato 4 and Cato 5, Cato is a very prominent anti-federalist author, and he talks about this very topic. And he talks, and so to answer that particular question, absolutely, the anti-federalists did talk about both the way the Constitution is structured and their fear that the powers would not remain separated, and in particular with respect to delegations from Article 1, namely the legislature or Congress, to Article 2, the executive branch. And so there is a nice reading list for the
Okay, weapons. Well, go read his concurrence because it truly is masterful. Okay.
Yeah, well, let's go back and forth.
Yeah.
Thank you both for joining us tonight. Judge Oldham, you mentioned, I believe, that one of your mentors said the Federalist Papers, they're just legislative history, they're just propaganda. And you responded a little bit to the legislative history point, but I wonder how each of you would respond to the charge that the Federalist Papers and the Anti-Federalist Papers, they're sort of propaganda at the time. They're not genuinely representing maybe what Alexander Hamilton or other folks thought of the Constitution. You know, how do you respond to that kind of criticism about what those papers are expressing?
Well, I think it's absolutely, I mean, it's true that most people at the time did not know who were writing these essays. Hamilton was obviously the sort of motive force behind Federalist thought. And one of the things that is a great tragedy of history is that for various reasons, we don't know who many of the anti-Federalists are even today. We have suspicions, but even in the time that I've been out of law school, we have discovered new information and discovered new evidence as to changing suggested authors of various anti-Federalist essays. So I'm not sure we'll ever actually settle these things. Judge Thapar mentioned Mercy Otis Warren. That was in the sort of middle of the 20th century we figured that out, and that seems to be settled. But there's a bunch of them. For example, Federal Farmer, who's a very influential anti-Federalist thought, essay and leader of anti-Federalist thought, that we don't know. We're actually not sure exactly who wrote that paper. So I think it's fair to say it's anonymous. I think it's also fair to say that each of the essays has an agenda. That might be true, but I think it might also be irrelevant in the sense that it only matters if the thing you're using it for is the substantive content of the essay. If instead what you're doing is reading it to think about exactly how the ratification debates were proceeding, I mean, we still look at things like, for example, Eliot's debates on the ratification of the Constitution. We listen to what people were saying on the floor of the various ratification halls in the various states as they were ratifying the Constitution. Those things matter deeply to understanding what the Constitution means today, because those things are part and parcel of the way people understood text and language and words to be used in the 18th century. So why would it matter if it was said by a person using his own name or her own name on the floor of a hall versus anonymously in a newspaper published a few months before? I would submit to you that it all goes to the usage of language, and it's all therefore relevant.
I agree.
Perfect.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth from the Georgetown chapter, and I just wanted to ask you both about the fact that so much of what you do as lower, you know, circuit court judges is controlled by Supreme Court precedent, and in your role as a circuit judge, how do you incorporate these sorts of originalist debates about the role of Federalist and Anti-Federalist and, you know, other aspects of originalism within the constraints of the precedent you have to operate under from the Supreme Court? Thank you.
Yeah, so that is something I think we all have to deal with and struggle with at different times. And there's two ways. One is there's times where it's not clear that Supreme Court precedent controls, and we can talk about and look back and have to figure it out. And that happens. There's other times, and we both love and respect the Supreme Court and, of course, follow their precedent, but we've been known to voice our opinions as well in dissents or concurrences and express what the original meaning was and how we've strayed away from it. And sometimes we both just plant nuggets and we think about it and we say, hey, this is out there. Someone should be paying attention to it. And in the appropriate case, we would.
Yeah, I agree. We absolutely follow Supreme Court precedent. Obviously, when they tell us what the answers are, we follow those and have utmost respect for it. One of the things consistent with that obligation is the court has told us that we should care about the original meaning of the Constitution. They've done that specifically in instructions to us in specific cases, but they've also said it in the illustrations of the way they go about analyzing constitutional questions. So when we're answering a question, as Judge Thapar points out, that hasn't gone to the Supreme Court yet, and the Supreme Court hasn't given us the answer, I view it as consistent with the instructions the court has given us on the methodology about answering that question, that we should care deeply about what happened in the 1780s.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'm too loud. I have two closely intertwined questions. The first of all, insofar as what we're looking for is the usage of language and the meaning of words, I'm wondering if you can shed some light on the relative advantages and disadvantages of looking at these essays as opposed to other contemporaneous writings, maybe not directly about the Constitution. And relatedly, how do you account for the politically motivated nature of these essays and any bias that may introduce into the interpretations of what these words mean?
Yeah, I mean, my view is our obligation is to look at everything. And I know different judges, justices have different views. So Justice Scalia limited the amount of things he would look at, whereas Justice Thomas was much more open to looking at a broad spectrum of materials. I would say, in my view, we should look at everything. And as Judge Oldham said, we should look at everything with an eye towards figuring out the original meaning of the Constitution. And so for me, the more materials I can get my hand on, whether it's cases right around the time, whether it's the ratification debates from the states, and Pauline Meyer, I think is how you pronounce her last name, has written a great book on ratification that's worth reading. But the newspapers from the time, the corpus from the time, anything I can get my hands on that relates to it, I'm going to use to try and figure out what the original meaning is. That's my view of how I do it. Different judges have different views.
Yeah, and I'll seize on one word that Judge Thapar just used, which is corpus. If anyone's ever thought about corpus linguistics as a methodology of thinking about the Constitution, the whole premise of that methodology is that we should look at a broad database of language usage, and we should use that to inform our understanding of how words were used at a particular time. Well, one thing that was quite surprising to me to learn is that one of the principal corpus linguistics databases, right? This is supposed to be a database that includes the text of multiple sources of language used in the 1780s, doesn't include a single Anti-Federalist essay. It includes the Federalist essays and not the Anti-Federalist essays. So for those who think, okay, well, we should go and use these databases and think about the way to use them to research language usage, that would be a gaping hole, right? And it doesn't really have anything to do with what was motivating particular people or particular people's intentions or anything else. It's just about using the communicative content of words to understand how they were used in the 1780s. That was obviously different in some ways than it is today, and that's what makes the research exercise so valuable.
And to Judge Oldham's point, you have to understand the pitfalls with the things you're using. And so you have to know the positives and negatives. And this is what makes clerking for an originalist judge so hard is we can't, and Emily, who clerks for me and is just this amazing clerk, laughs because I come in and I say, don't you wish I was a living constitutionalist? I could tell you the answer and you could go home at 3. And instead, she's there at 11 o'clock at night, pouring through the stuff, trying to figure out every source, every piece, and what the pitfalls are with it. And so I think that's the reality of the difficulty of the job. Don't think it's easy. Don't think we aren't professional historians. We know what we lack. And it's a hard job to figure it out. Do you want to?
No, please.
Hi. Thank you so much for being here. My question is, I am wondering whether you agree with the Anti-Federalists that a Bill of Rights was indeed necessary to protect individual rights, or whether and to what extent you are sympathetic to the Federalist argument that having a government with limited enumerated powers would be sufficient to protect individual rights, and that by having certain rights be elevated over others might actually have the ill effect of curbing the rights that people retained at the founding.
You want me to go?
I'm happy, whichever.
So why don't you go? Because I'll drone on about this forever.
Yeah. So I'll try to answer this succinctly in this way. Obviously, the structural provisions of the Constitution are essential, absolutely essential. No doubt about it. Without those, or I should put it differently, those are the primary guarantors of individual liberty, as late Justice Scalia used to say. And so I think that you can absolutely concede that premise and still understand the importance of the Bill of Rights. And the way I try to explain the Bill of Rights and why it was so important to the Anti-Federalists and why it's so important just generally is twofold. One is that if you just talk to an average American about something that's in the Constitution, I think you're going to get one of two answers. Either they're going to tell you they don't know anything that's in the Constitution, or they're going to point to something that's in the Bill of Rights, right? Those are the things that people think of when they think about their Constitution. It's something in the Bill of Rights. Perhaps they get to the 14th Amendment, which obviously came later, but it's something that's in the Bill of Rights. So that's one reason that we should care about it. But the other one, and this is really a deep and profound historical reason, is that it's really important to understand, if you can put yourself back into the time of the 1780s, there was a long tradition that went back at least to 1215 in Magna Carta of people writing down their rights against their government. Right? When the barons met with King John at Runnymede, they were writing down their rights against their government. And that tradition had been followed. It was followed in the Petition of Right. It was followed in the English Bill of Rights. It was followed in the state constitutions and the state bills of rights. It was expected that if we were going to have a general government, which is the whole point of the Constitutional Convention, that we would have our rights written down so that we could preserve those against the new government that we were creating. And so part of the Anti-Federalist response, which has very little to do with like the actual, is it actually the primary guarantor of rights, or is it instead the structural provisions, is just a reaction to the idea that we would both create a new government, give it new powers, invigorate it. This was Hamilton's entire idea, right? We're going to invigorate this new general government and not write down the rights that people were so used to for five centuries seeing written down in their constitutions. So I think that's part of what was driving the Anti-Federalist objection. And it's part of the reason Madison recognized the strength of that objection is why the first Congress sat down to write the First Amendment.
Yeah, and of course, Judge Oldham's 100% right. The other two things, just two quick things to remember, is the British were trampling the colonies' rights, the individuals' rights. And so this was a time when they were very worried about replacing one tyrannical government with another one. And the second thing that always struck me, Justice Scalia was so good at this. And what struck me about what he always said is take a look at countries like North Korea. They have more rights written down than we're ever going to have. And yet, would you trade being here for being there? And that, to me, answers the importance of structure of government. So they're both necessary. The Anti-Federalists weren't saying, we just want our rights. They believed in the structure of government. In fact, they wanted a harder core structure of government. But they understood that one without the other wasn't sufficient, just like Justice Scalia did. And he said the Bill of Rights aren't worth anything without the structure of government. And we know that because we can look at countries like North Korea and see how much their Bill of Rights is worth.
So this is more of a conspiracy theory type of question.
We plead guilty. We're co-conspirators.
Alrighty. There's a theory out there that the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists are actually the same people that are writing just from different perspectives and analyzing every side of their arguments. What are your thoughts on that theory? And do you have any beliefs in regards to that?
You can go.
I think that's a tough one. And one reason it's tough is the private correspondence of the Federalists were quite irritated with the Anti-Federalists. You can see the irritation in some of the essays as the Federalists are trying to respond to Anti-Federalist argument. But it's not like the only thing we know about what Hamilton thought about the Constitution comes from the essays he wrote. We also have his private papers. We have papers that Madison was writing to Jefferson. There's a bunch of private correspondence that makes me think that this was not a charade, that they were very different people. And the other problem with it is that there's a whole bunch of anti-Federalists who, as I mentioned earlier, don't need pseudonyms and really were actually staunchly opposed. In Virginia, it's hard to talk about the anti-Federalists without talking about Patrick Henry and the spirited speech he gave, an absolute fiery speech that he gave in the Virginia House as they were ratifying the Constitution. And again, he wasn't doing that with a pseudonym, and I think it would be really difficult to listen to a single word he said and think he didn't mean it.
And remember, some of the people that are anti-Federalists walked out of the convention without the doc. And so that, and then you don't even need to read the anti-Federalist papers to know the conspiracy theory isn't true, because if you read the Federalist papers and you pay attention, in a lot of them, they're very demeaning to the anti-Federalists in a way they wouldn't have been if they were just trying to stage a debate.
I don't know how I'm supposed to follow up to that question, honestly, but I'll try. So in Federalist 37, which I think was Madison, they talk about how even the best documents are ultimately ambiguous documents to some extent. And ultimately, what we just need to do is liquidate. He uses the term liquidate them over time through established precedent and practice. So dropping the issue of like stare decisis and following higher courts just in a vacuum, how are we as originalists, how ought we deal with the issue of constitutional liquidation? And ultimately, when do we just have to stop the project of trying to perfect original meaning and just accept that some things got settled over time?
Yeah, that's so I'll go first on this, and I'll just say that's a great question and a difficult question. And there's two, you probably know this, there's two law professors who have written very, very, and I'm sorry if I'm leaving anyone out, thoughtful pieces on this. First, Virginia's own Caleb Nelson has written about liquidation, and then Will Bode and at Chicago. And what I would say is that those two articles are worth reading, and I can't do better. Judge Oldham can. This is where you're going to see we're not truly brothers, because here comes the brilliance.
No, that's far be it for me. I had the incredible, you want to talk about humbling experiences. I had occasion to clerk with Will Bode and Professor Walker. So if you ever want to feel like the dumbest man in the room, you should sit and listen to them talk to each other. But I will say, it's very difficult whenever we're going to talk about liquidation, it's very hard to just put a pin in stare decisis and precedent. The whole point is that experience and time is what is going to help us understand how these provisions work and mean. And so I think in some ways the premise is what's frustrating. And so I agree with Judge Sipar 100%. There's a ton of great scholarship on this. The thing that I think is incredibly important is that before we move on from the 1780s, that we are confident that we have a good understanding of what happened there. And so I think that's part of, it's completely possible to say that things after the 1780s are relevant, while also saying we need to have a better understanding of what the founding generation thought of the Constitution.
Which side? Over here.
Thank you for coming. Ajay from NYU.
I'm sorry to interrupt you just for a second. I'm sorry to tell everyone this is the last question. Yep, this is the last question.
I'm very happy I got to get my question before then.
Yeah, it better be a good one.
Oh, okay. Well, we'll see.
No, I'm kidding. They're all good.
So in my opinion, one of the reasons that the Federalist is so widely read is because it consolidates like the Federalist movement into one set of essays. The anti-Federalists were incredibly varied in their opinions. And we're not necessarily... they didn't necessarily completely agree, like the federal farmer, maybe on like freedom of conscience, may not fully agree with Brutus. How do you reconcile that, and how does that affect how we interpret them and their weight in terms of the constitutional interpretation?
So this is a great question, by the way, so good job.
Yeah, good job doing it. And I'm sorry to that long string of people who didn't get a chance to ask a question. We were droning on too much. I'm sorry that we didn't get to all of them. So I would answer it in two different ways. One, you mentioned Federal Farmer. I think that if you read the Federal Farmer essays, they have both the same structure as the Federalist and some of the same breadth. And in fact, that's why Hamilton mentions that Federal Farmer is his most worthy adversary in the Federalist Papers. So I think some of them clearly do have exactly the same coherence, or at least arguably the same coherence. And second, to the extent that they disagree with each other, I actually find that to be an asset and not a detriment, because you just have more material to read to understand. So Brutus very rarely disagrees with Brutus, right? Obviously, it's a cohesive series of essays. And so to the extent that Brutus and Cato might disagree with Federal Farmer or some combination of them with the other, I think that just goes to show you that any particular provision of the Constitution may have a range of meaning. But it also helps you delimit that range of meaning. And so whichever way you think about it, whether they're agreeing, they're disagreeing, it's all useful. And there is, I've never heard a justification for just ignoring it.
Yeah, I want to finish by, I'm just going to go off script now, and thank you all very much for having us and being so attentive. We are really honored to be up here and talk about something that's a passion for both of us. And we hope, the questions are just fantastic, and it shows that you all are brilliant and working hard at truly engaging with the enterprise and reading both the Anti-Federalists and Federalists. As I think we both referenced, there's a lot of other things, of course, to read when you're figuring out the original meaning, but it's really important that the Anti-Federalists be included if you truly want to understand the Constitution. And so we can't thank you enough for having us here, letting us talk about our passion, and Rachel for coming up with this idea along with her fellow classmates at the time, and then it continuing to live on, and Chloe allowing it to continue to live on, and actually making it happen. And so really all the hard work was done by these UVA law students, and they did a phenomenal job with this conference. Really, it ran seamlessly for a time when sometimes masks are still in fashion and other times they're not. We really appreciated them navigating that gray line and pulling off an amazing conference. So, if there's anyone to thank, it's the UVA students.
And I'll just conclude with Wahoo Wah.